The economy got some bad news yesterday. The Labor Department said that unemployment rose to 9.8% in September. That's worse than expected, and it suggests the road to recovery may be longer than many economists thought. NPR's Chris Arnold reports.
Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke recently said that the recession is likely over, but he cautioned that it's not going to feel like that to many Americans for a while. And this latest jobs report proves that. 15 million Americans are now out of work. One in six people are underemployed, and it doesn't look like that's going to get better anytime soon.
What's troubling about this report is that the forward-looking information is not healthy or positive.
David Kotak is chief investment officer at Cumberland Advisors. He says, for example, many people are working fewer hours a week, which suggests that companies are not going to start hiring much yet if they can just give their current workers more hours. Also, he says, more people are discouraged and not even looking for work. All of this is bound to be a drag on consumer spending, the housing market, the whole economy.
When it comes to this economic recovery, it is going to be slow. The growth rates will be tepid. And the workout in the labor side, job side, is going to take years and years. And that is likely to be the case right through to the next presidential election.
President Obama said yesterday that employment is often the last thing to come back after a recession, but the president said he is exploring additional measures to promote job creation.
And I want to let every single American know that I will not let up until those who are seeking work can find work.
Meanwhile, David Kotak says this disappointing jobs report makes economists worry at least a little bit more that the economic recovery might fizzle. This is the fear of the so-called W-shaped recession, where things start to turn up but then go down again into a second dip.
If we had a couple more months like this, then the answer would be yes, we're headed into the W. The dreaded W is happening.
Still, on the brighter side, the pace of job losses is slowing. Stuart Hoffman is chief economist of PNC Financial Services Group. He says lately the economy's been losing around 250,000 jobs a month. That's bad, but much less bad than earlier this year.
In the second quarter, it was about 450,000 jobs per month. And in the awful, awful first quarter, the opening quarter of this year, we were losing over 700,000 jobs per month.
Hoffman's more optimistic than some. He thinks we'll start to see some job gains early next year. Also, his bank just completed a survey of small business owners. Only half as many are expecting layoffs as compared to 6 months ago, and they're getting a bit more confident about the future.
And I tell you, last month we had a terrific month.
That's Dieter Weissenrieder, the founder of Weiss Aug Inc., a metal parts manufacturing company in New Jersey. The company makes parts for medical devices, including certain types of syringes. Earlier this year, the company had some layoffs, but things are looking better now.
That, but the swine flu has definitely helped us.
But Weissenrieder says he's also seeing business pick up from lots of different sources. He says car manufacturers, electronics companies, and others have new products that they've developed during the recession, but that got put on the shelf until the economy started to look better. You're starting to see some of that get made now? Or?
Absolutely, yes. I mean, that's the new work that I'm seeing right now.
Other business owners aren't so optimistic, but everyone's watching the data to see what course the economy is charting on this slow journey towards a recovery. Chris Arnold, NPR News.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Today, we're going to talk about the future of the business we are in. I don't mean to get personal so soon in the program, but did you read a newspaper this weekend, catch the news? If you did, we thank you. If you didn't, well, you're not alone. If you have picked up a paper lately, you can probably tell the traditional news business is in deep trouble. Newspapers are getting thinner. Many of them are folding altogether. The reach of the coverage has shrunk for many news organizations, and of course, reporter and editor jobs are disappearing. As a matter of fact, according to a new report by Unity, the Journalists of Color, that's a consortium representing four journalist associations, since the recession began, journalism jobs have evaporated at a rate almost three times that of positions in the general economy. We're going to devote much of today's program to looking at various aspects of the journalism crisis, and we're going to start off with a part of the media that has been hardest hit, print journalism. Newspapers have been devastated as advertisers have transferred their budgets from hard copy to online page views. U.S. Senator Ben Cardin, Democrat of Maryland, believes he has a lifeline. This past March, he introduced the Newspaper Revitalization Act, which would give newspapers that regularly publish local, national, and international news the option of becoming tax-exempt nonprofits. Senator Cardin joins us now from his home in Maryland. Welcome. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Michelle, it's a pleasure to be with you.
What inspired your sponsorship of this bill? I know that your hometown paper, the Baltimore Sun, has had many of the difficulties that we've talked about nationally.
Well, I think local newspapers are critically important to our democratic system. They're a check and balance on what we do in government, what happens in business, what happens in our community. And more of our local bureaus are being closed. You know, I know people get their news on the internet and they say, gee, why do we need the local paper? Well, most of the news comes from those investigative reporters who work for newspapers. That's where they get the source of their information. And if we lose those local news bureaus, we're really losing a lot. So I'm trying to keep an independent local newspaper going by giving them an additional source for revenue through local contribution.
Why is legislation needed for this? Why can't they simply use existing mechanisms to transform their corporate structures if they so choose?
Well, they can, and some have. We know that some affiliated with faith-based groups or educational institutions have been nonprofits and are able to get contributions from the community. The problem is that IRS makes that difficult for a traditional local newspaper. Because they get so much of their revenues through advertising and subscriptions, the IRS has taken the position that they can't qualify as a nonprofit. My legislation would allow them to continue to get revenues through subscriptions and advertising, which are very much down, but also to be able to get local community support through contributions, basically maintaining their independent status.
Have newspapers expressed interest? And I also should mention, for the sake of full disclosure, for those who don't know, that NPR, National Public Radio, is a nonprofit along the lines of what we're talking about here, but it has always been a nonprofit. There was no conversion of status, as it were.
There is interest. Quite frankly, there needs to be more interest if this legislation is to move in the United States Congress. Local newspapers are going to have to come forward and say that they want to do this.
Why do you think they're not more interested? Is it you think that they're just so preoccupied with survival that they're not as open to other options as they could be? It's just they're sort of preoccupied with their day-to-day existence? Or why do you think that is?
Well, I think that's part of it. I think also is that many have been taken over by large conglomerates, and the large conglomerates are in trouble, and it's unlikely that they could become a nonprofit. So I think it's mainly the structures that they've gotten themselves into and the current competition. They look at themselves as competing on the internet, and yet they are basically giving their product away free on the internet. So the current business model does not work, and I don't think they're really focused on how to survive.
One objection that I've heard is that if newspapers were to become nonprofits, that they couldn't endorse candidates. They could editorialize as they do now, but they could not endorse specific candidates. And for some, this is a real problem because they say, well, on the national level, perhaps it's not as big of an issue, but on the local level, a lot of people really do rely on the endorsements of local newspapers. People say, look, I don't have time to follow these races closely, the school board, the county council, and so forth. I really need this. It's really part of the service. What do you say to that?
One of the restrictions on a nonprofit is that they cannot directly get involved in an election. That's a requirement for a nonprofit. They can editorialize. They can comment about an elected official. They can get involved in a local political situation as far as reporting about it. But the one restriction is that they can't endorse a candidate. The paper will have to make a choice. If that's so important to it, then find a different way to survive.
Is it surprising to you, though, that there does not seem to be as much interest in this as one would think? I mean, the fact of a newspaper closing generates a headline for a day, a couple of days. I mean, it's certainly a national story. Certainly journalists are very interested in it. I cited those job loss figures, which are quite remarkable. As we said, that the rate of job loss since the recession began in this industry is three times that of the general economy. And yet there doesn't seem to be a sense of urgency around it. I mean, does that suggest that perhaps people just don't value it? They don't value these institutions?
So I hear from people in the community all the time. I hear from people who are either reporters or associated with newspapers telling me, we really got to get this done. I hear a great deal of interest in the need to look at other revenue sources to keep local papers open. What I don't hear from are the institutions themselves, and I think that's mainly because they are so wounded today, they're so weakened, that they just are not focused on their survival. Maybe they've just sort of reached a conclusion that they're not going to be around. And I think what people confuse is how we get our news. I fully expect that there will come a day that we may not have the printed paper at our doorsteps, that our grandchildren might be telling us, did you really cut down trees in order to read papers? We know we can get the information electronically, and most people are moving towards electronically getting their news. But you need to maintain the local news bureau, the investigative reporting, and they need to have revenue sources. So the contributions is one, looking for revenues on the internet is another, but we need to preserve this institution that we called our local newspapers. And unfortunately, that's becoming a real challenge today, but I think the community wants it. I can tell you that those that have been involved in journalism think it's very important to maintain the independent investigative capacity of a paper. And that's what we really need to work on to preserve.
Senator Ben Cardin is a Democrat of Maryland. He has introduced the Newspaper Revitalization Act, and he was kind enough to join us from his home office in Maryland. Senator, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Michelle, thanks for doing this show. It's important.
The new credit card law protects consumers against high fees, surprise hikes in interest rates, and abusive billing practices. It won't take effect until February, and some lawmakers want to push up that start date. They say credit card companies are taking advantage of the lag time to raise rates and slash credit limits. NPR's Audie Cornish reports.
The new law passed in May prevents banks from arbitrarily changing the interest rate on a customer's existing balance. It also bars banks, among other things, from charging interest on debt that a consumer has paid off on time. Last spring, bankers told Congress they needed time to reprogram computers and get ready for all the new rules. Meanwhile, lawmakers say in the last few months, card issuers have lowered credit limits, raised rates, and switched customers from fixed to variable rate cards.
Too many in the banking system seem to think that they can return to the thrilling days of yesteryear when the loan arrangers will write again unhindered by any kind of regulation. And that simply is not acceptable.
That's House Financial Services Chairman Barney Frank, and he wants the new law to take effect on December 1st instead of waiting till 2010.
Good. They should move it up to November.
Janet Thompson, visiting the Capitol from Chevy Chase, Maryland, got letters recently from two of her credit card companies. The first bank doubled her interest rate. The second did the same. And when she argued the rate back down, the company slashed her credit limit from $7,000 to $500.
They're taking advantage, and they've made all sorts of money during this time by arbitrarily raising it. You know, we always pay early. We always pay more. You know, we'd like to pay it all off. And we used to do that every year when I was working, but I lost my job. I can't pay it all off.
And she doesn't want to close the credit accounts because that would ding her credit score. Thompson and her husband are now retirees carrying two mortgages. They're frustrated with the way they say their banks are treating them. But the scenario Thompson describes is exactly why banks are changing rates, according to Scott Talbot of the Financial Services Roundtable.
We are in a recession, and there is a greater increased risk that a customer won't pay their credit card that's spread across the board. So even some customers who haven't done anything wrong or not missed a payment or not been late are seeing an increase in their interest rate or a decrease in their credit line simply because of this general increased riskiness in our current economy.
Talbot says December 1st is too soon to put that much regulation into action. But Nick Bork of the Safe Credit Cards Project at the Pew Charitable Trust disagrees.
What makes sense is to stop repricing outstanding balances as quickly as possible. Banks can stop doing that right away.
Bork says some provisions of the law have and should go into effect as soon as possible to protect consumers. But other parts, like a rule that fees should be reasonable, need more time. It's going to be up to the Federal Reserve to figure out what terms like reasonable actually mean.
What I'm a little concerned about is that the Federal Reserve has enough time to make the right rules. And if the Fed doesn't have time to create really strong rules, then I think ultimately consumers will be hurt by that.
Still, the House Financial Services Committee plans to take up the legislation as early as this week. Congressman Frank says he's eager to move well before holiday shoppers hit the malls with their plastic. Audie Cornish, NPR News, The Capitol.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Melissa Block.
And I'm Robert Siegel. The economy may be improving, but the job market is not. Job losses worsened in September as the country shed more than 250,000 jobs. The nation's unemployment rate ticked up to 9.8%. President Obama spoke about the news today, just after returning from Copenhagen.
Today's job report is a sobering reminder that progress comes in fits and starts, and that we're going to need to grind out this recovery, step by step.
Here's more from NPR's Frank Langfitt.
John Sylvia is chief economist with Wells Fargo Securities, and this morning he captured the reaction of many to the September jobs report.
Well, that wasn't any fun. Holy cow.
Holy cow, indeed. 263,000 jobs disappeared in September. That's about 60,000 more than in August. In other words, after steady improvement, job cuts are going in the wrong direction, and those losses are deepening even as analysts believe the economy is beginning to grow. Sylvia says that suggests the U.S. is almost certainly entering
a jobless recovery. You know, moderate economic growth, maybe 2.5% or so. Growth not fast enough to generate the kind of jobs that most people are going to come to expect, and especially what politicians would like to see.
For the nation's unemployed, who now number more than 15 million, a jobless recovery would be brutal. The number of unemployed would continue to grow, and people would remain out of work even longer. After today's report came out, Vice President Joe Biden tried to reassure people that employment will improve.
Today's bad news does not change my confidence in the fact that we are going to recover. We will be producing jobs.
But when? The signs in today's job report aren't encouraging. Employers usually increase workers' hours before hiring new ones. But last month, companies actually cut hours. Another harbinger of job growth is temporary employment.
Employers will hire temp workers first to sort of test the waters of a recovery.
That's Heidi Shierholz. She's an economist with the Economic Policy Institute, a labor think tank in Washington. But Shierholz noted that last month, temp services still shed more than 1,000 jobs.
We need to see temp workers turn up first before we will see recovery in the larger economy.
Sean Carroll may be on the leading edge of that change. He's the chief financial officer with Crown Services. It's a temp company in Ohio, which provides workers to hospitals, auto suppliers, and other manufacturers. Carroll says clients began asking for more workers a few months ago, but he doesn't expect demand to return to pre-recession levels until next summer.
I don't see people going back and spending like they used to.
Carroll says during the recession, clients learned to operate with smaller workforces, and they're reluctant to add more workers until they see clear signs of recovery. Carroll feels that way, too.
I know in our case, I decreased hours at headquarters, and we're still getting the job done.
Do you see any point when you would begin hiring again directly for the company?
Yeah, well, I mean, there's been managers that have mentioned my sales are up. I need to start thinking about another coordinator.
What do you say?
Well, I say, you know, you if you think you can do it with what you have, I would give that a shot first.
Other chief financial officers are taking the same approach. In a recent poll by Duke University and CFO Magazine, most companies said it would take several years for employment to return to pre-recession levels. Frank Langfitt, NPR News, Washington.